in rapture of service dance my boat and I sail. An ancient cosmic mask I shall unveil. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 16. Masks and Cameras. Ironically, after receiving my name, I lost some of my focus. A spiritual name could not automatically negate the less divine and cooperative parts of myself, but I could not simply unlearn the conscious knowledge of my soul's qualities on the days I felt like being grumpy or otherwise ignorant either. So the bar of my behaviour had been permanently raised. Perhaps complacency crept in when I reached that cherished goal, or maybe for me, the longing itself was dearer than the prize. Increasingly, I found myself on the spot and in the limelight, two places I tended to avoid at any cost. According to Sri Chinmoy's teachings and my own experience, I knew that weaknesses could not be conquered in one blow. They spiral back again with increasingly refined disguises. My age-old friend's shyness came back to nettle me on the next Christmas trip in China, and I railed against it like never before. Although I did not avoid people, per se, I avoided speaking out in any circumstance and worried for the opinions of others, constantly. Sri Chinmoy sat in the annex of a hotel ballroom somewhere in Sanya. His legs had become yet more painful, so he allowed new doctors to treat him, but still his creativity flowed on like a mountain stream from the crystal summits of his meditation. There was barely any space for us to take dictation, so we entered one by one. The air smelled of menthol and cloves from some relieving substance. There were open bags and bottles, two disciple boys and two local men crouching or sitting, passing things to one another in a low murmur. I entered at my turn and waited in the only space available. While the master was in discussion about some technical matter, I thought it best not to satisfy my curiosity by watching or listening, so I took the time to pray for new verve and illumination. To be a God lover is much easier than to be a God server, he said slowly and deliberately, as though calling from afar. As I turned to leave, layered memories opened in my mind like the pages of a book. The sense I had in Edinburgh to give and give and give. The line in my name's meaning that my service must be unconditional. The way my satisfaction soared in New York when I tried to serve others rather than counting the things I did not have. To be happy, I knew I had to give to the God in others instead of longing to receive. Sri Chinmoy knew very well what it meant to offer one's life in service. To hear him admit that it may be challenging for a beginner gave me strength enough to at least resume my efforts. Entering one by one became the norm after that, and more often than not, just the master sat inside their little room. It was the only time I was ever by myself with him. Often he reclined on a couch, resting his legs. Except for his modern clothes, it could have been a scene from any age. Although the body was present, the rest of him was gone to some other time or realm. The silence was dense as a forest, so I almost did not dare to tread there, even in my stocking feet. The tiny scratch of my pen seemed clamorous. Sri Chinmoy loved to take boat rides, so a trip was arranged for all of us before we left the coast. On the lower of three decks was a room with a wide door to the outside, where his chair looked out over the South China Sea. Rows of fishing junks butted against one another at the jetty. Dark flags pointed out above turned wooden railings, perched along blunt, formidable boughs. Families wearing contented smiles moved slowly and talked loudly from smaller vessels, peering out at us from behind piles of netting. Beyond the port was only a wide, misty blue, and the ocean seemed to carry the master new inspiration like a water-bound feast. He reclined there in the passing breeze, composing lilting songs into a microphone. His voice was only melting tenderness, and my heart strained to contain its joy. Sri Chinmoy took to dictating in the main function room at Xiamen, where we settled next. Sometimes he would obviously be traversing distant inner landscapes while composing, so it may be difficult to hear him. Or he might trail off halfway through a line and ask to be reminded of how far he had got. If he changed a word later in a poem, it may not be clear whether other words should also reflect that change or should be left as they were. It was thus sometimes necessary to interject, perhaps reading back part of the poem and asking for confirmation on certain words. I dreaded this happening. I was already terrified of being on the spot, even if the poem was perfectly obvious first time. Often there would be only a short pause between poems, so it was not polite to linger. The master seemed to journey a long way before he spoke at my turn one day, leaving me unsure of a word. I read back the aphorism as clearly as I could, but apparently I was too quiet, so I called out a second time at quite a volume. "I cannot hear her," he said to someone near me, seemingly annoyed. I was stumped. He had no such trouble with others whose voices were so soft that I struggled to pick them up myself. "There is not a single human being who can escape the world's stark criticism," I roared for a third time. "Right." I thought at first he simply wanted me to make that affirmation, as it was wholly appropriate for me. But the same thing happened again and again with other poems, day after day, until I raged with frustration. Only in my silent fury did I finally realize it was inner volume he was listening for. While outwardly I was bellowing, inside I was still a mouse, feverishly searching for the first chance of cover. We sat in a semicircle on that day. There was not quite room for us in one line, so I crept forward beside a plant. If I craned my neck a little at my turn, I knew I would be able to see him. As he spoke, he leaned back, though, his face disappearing behind a large clock, so I had no choice but to stand. The master was absolutely in another world. He began, repeated a phrase, changed it, went back into another world, said something I could not make out, repeated it and changed it again, and then asked me to read it back to him. The others looked up at me with sympathy while I did my best, one or two laughing gently at my earnest bewilderment. It went on like that for some time. At last the poem made no sense to me at all, and I looked to my friends for confirmation. Shrugs and shaking heads answered me. I asked the master if I could check it, wincing as he perceptibly climbed down flights of stairs to answer the call of the earthly doorbell. Instead of bellowing, I read it back with confidence and at a natural volume. He seemed almost disheartened at having to craft his otherworldly wanderings using only the primitive tools of English, but at least I did not seem to be the cause of any irritation, and he gave me then two very clear and compact sentences. My theory had worked, and the game of inner versus outer sound was over. The master was requesting more and more plays for amusement in the evening functions. I usually hid whenever the subject came up, leaving directing and even bit parts of acting to those with more pizzazz. But as always, my guru's aphorisms helped fine-tune my perceptions. "Do not be jealous of others' talents. Use your own talents. God will be highly pleased with you," he dictated one morning. Admittedly, I was jealous of those who had the courage to put on plays, because I had not yet addressed that fear in myself. I decided the time had come to face it, by using my own strengths instead of trying to emulate those of others. Near the time of my departure, I found a shop that sold felt pens and card, so I could make paper masks. I wrote a humorous script in rhyming verse from one of Sri Chinmoy's stories, an illustration of divine love based around Sri Krishna. The parts were to be spoken off stage for the masked players on their behalf, while they mimed the actions themselves. As a concession to my shyness, everyone was thus effectively hiding for the whole play. The lines could be more elaborate than if they had to be learned by heart, but the oneness between player and speaker still required care and practice. I was almost certain it would be a disaster up until the moment it began. A whiteboard was wheeled out to the front of the stage before each function, from which the master would read out the names of the directors. Although my name was written quite clearly, when he got to it he squinted and frowned and attempted, then finally moved on to the next one. I knew he was playing. It seemed an apt reminder to either speak up or dissolve once again into the cold obscurity of my own fear. In fact, although so many things could have gone wrong, the night was laden with magic and miracles, such that we almost could not fail. "Come and pass by," called the master at the end as a way to honour us. "Stand in front and take off the masks so everyone can see." He placed the dumbbell he had been using on the ground so as to join the applause. Not only was the play acceptable by general standards, but even those I revered came heaping their praise on us. I filed up to the front for prasad at the end of the evening, not even hoping for my guru's glance, when a single syllable reached the microphone. "Ba," meaning good. It was more than enough for me. If God can make a director of me, even fleetingly, I thought, he really can make anything of anybody. The next day I felt more alive than ever, having challenged so much terror. My every sense found an exquisite intensity. I went for a walk at dawn to say goodbye to China. The public park almost reached saturation point by 7 in the morning. A dark tangle of bicycles formed a complex, unintentional sculpture at the entrance. 3 long stone hoops created a gateway, each one crested by curled green tiers of roof tiles. As if locked in some darkened oil painting, clusters of Mahjong players converged on stone tables. Smoke hung like carded wool between them and the awning of trees above. Some practiced Tai Chi alone, and others formed groups. I let myself be mesmerized. While they moved as one body, acutely conscious of one another, their faces betrayed only an inner awareness. Each face was devoid of expression, basking in the serenity of concentration. Tiny children stumped around with overflowing energy as they would anywhere in the world, their fine porcelain faces touched with bloom. Nothing seemed an excuse for inactivity. Even the most wizened were out shuffling or stretching with what vigour they had at their disposal. I came across a bamboo thicket, each stem completely covered in graffiti characters, carved into the green skin to reveal yellow. I was glad not to know what it all meant, to see it not as defacement, but as ornament. I continued to the vast and placid scenes of a botanical garden. In the damp breath of morning, huge rounded rocks adorned the edges of a lake. Through mist, an ornate summer house, open to all sides, jutted out into the depths. All thoughts were suddenly hijacked by its classic splendour. Trees reflected their softened versions in the water. I reflected on a life composed of love and beauty. Within that silence there was space for a fount of gratitude. A steep hill behind invited me to a higher viewpoint. I accepted and climbed. The town looked toy-like, tall buildings rendered squat. The sun stretched warm hands out to me through a haze broken by branches. There was a tangible stillness beyond the mere lack of movement, a living stillness. I was new again. I knew it then. Letting go the crutches of my daily routines, committing myself to my inner life and my guru's presence for 3 weeks was enough to realign my happiness and inspiration for months and maybe years to come. In spring, I headed for a significant yet notional point, unmarked by any visible border, where Slovenia joins Austria and Hungary. The forest air smelled of beer and roasting sausages, and through the greenery a cluster of marquees appeared. The sounds of concurrent speeches and performances grew closer. Crowds jostled thickly as I climbed. Some were in national costume, others wore aprons and sold drinks or flags out of crates. My ears still rang from Sri Chinmoy's concert in Ljubljana the night before, where I had ended up under a huge speaker waiting to take the stage. A powerful blessing of music for my heart at least, and a signal honour to sing for the national sporting heroes who had been invited to join the public audience. An award ceremony called Lifting Up the World with a Oneness Heart was Sri Chinmoy's unique way of celebrating the achievements of others. He would physically lift people above his head as a symbolic act of jubilation, like a sporting cheer in action, and as an extension of his self-transcendence in weightlifting. He lifted thousands of people over the years, of all ages and backgrounds. The equipment thus needed to be sturdy and safe but transportable to any event. Its ingenious structure was assembled from many metal pieces, custom made by a team of boys in New York, as were many other types of apparatus, built to accommodate the master's ever-evolving feats of strength. 10 countries were to join the European Union that day, and Sri Chinmoy had come from New York for the occasion. From all 3 nations whose borders met at that point, mayors and members of parliament were to be lifted. They took their turn at climbing narrow steps to the platform, individually or in 2s and 3s. Rising a few inches into the air for a moment by the strength of the master's arm, some smiled for the cameras, while others appeared inward and reflective. Stepping down again, they took a special medal from Sri Chinmoy, one by one. There was barely any space on the little ledge where the lifting took place. We had to bunch so near as to touch the base of the equipment. In that close-knit throng, I thought I caught a glimpse of why the master had travelled so far to some remote forest track, full of commotion and unfragrant air. That close to him and to the other disciples, I felt a tangible oneness unlike any other. It spread as though to the dignitaries, and then to the crowds, speeding out to the furthest borders of all 3 countries and beyond. Less than an hour before, the master was inspired to write a song to mark the day. Although we had almost no time to learn it, suddenly we were singing all the 7 lines anyway, for the crowds and guests and television cameras. There was nowhere to hide and no point searching for excuses. If nothing else, some poise and flexibility were forced to the fore in such situations. It was touching to be trusted by my guru to represent him in public, but it took some nerve to try and keep up with him. A plaque was unveiled, and the master gave a presentation in the main marquee. Then we all dispersed to find our buses. I was standing by the track, reeling from the power of it all, when Sri Chinmoy was driven slowly down the hill beside me, talking on the phone with the window down. He looked into my eyes for a moment, deliberately, as though telling me something, but I would never find out what it was. He had already embarked on his next activity before I began to absorb the one that had just happened. "Your birthday?" Sri Chinmoy asked through the car window outside Aspiration Ground a few weeks later. "Yes, Guru, tomorrow." "Tomorrow," he said firmly, with a nod, and smiled wide. Closing his eyes for a moment in meditation, he handed me a large foil-wrapped cookie, and the next girl stepped forward. I stood at the same place the following day, in a sari that matched my prasad. I had made little paper boxes at home for our group, printed around the edges with decorations and an auspicious aphorism by the master. They were filled with sweets in lilac wrapping and layers of matching tissue, sealed with a taffeta ribbon. "Your birthday today?" he asked. The boxes had been passed to him from his driver and were piled on his lap in a bag. "Yes, Guru." "Very good," he said, with more kindness than I could bear, as though I had done something terribly brave by being born. He held a box for hours before handing it to me, or so it seemed. My heart had stretched into timelessness. His eyes were closed, but in those moments, inches from him, nobody and nothing existed except we two, joined as though by some immortal strength. Treading the corridors of the United Nations headquarters that afternoon, I felt I was travelling through the arteries of the world. My journey's end was a small theatre where the master was to conduct his twice-weekly meditation. On a stage, a chair waited beside a narrow desk that held only a candle and a flower. Sri Chinmoy entered in a glowing yellow dhoti. He seated himself in a silence that seemed to grow into a long crescendo of peace over 15 minutes. A small group of disciples came forward to sing, and the master composed 4 new poems. As though his inner offering could not have been enough nourishment, he took truffles wrapped in foil, one by one, from a tray with his neat brown fingers and dropped them into the hands of each of us as we left. 3 days later, 8 of us sang in the gully and the master gave us prasad from the car. I beamed with joy and oneness as he offered my English friend a blessing meditation for her birthday, just as I had received. A boy was standing nearby with a camera, so he kindly thought to make a souvenir photograph. The tiniest flicker of envy sped across my mind like the shadow of a bird. There had been no camera for my birthday. I was last in line, so I had ample time to chase out the ridiculous thought before I reached my guru. As I approached, he turned away to one of the boys. Thinking he had resumed his old sport of ignoring me, I stood back a polite distance to let him speak, and perhaps even to give away the prasad I had hoped was mine. Then I realized it was the boy with the camera, and the master was asking him to take a photograph. A cardboard tube of biscuits came through the window toward me, but his hand kept it fast for a moment as I held the close aside. Whether he remembered there had been no camera for my birthday, or had read my unseemly desire from the back of the line, it was an equally sweet indulgence. I was dreading the bus to Buffalo a year later. I had heard we would go overnight on the way there and back the next night after the concert. Having already spent a night on a bus from Wales to Heathrow, that would make 3 bus nights in a row. It sounded worse than camping. But it was my birthday, and I was determined it would be a happy one. We were leaving in the morning, after all, and Sri Chinmoy was to make the 8-hour journey with us, so the wretched trek in my mind became an idyllic family outing in reality. The master composed poems, reading through a microphone behind the driver's seat, and we all repeated them aloud in unison. The freshness of the creations and depth of their meanings, accompanied by the concentration of hearing and correctly repeating the words, was at once clarifying and elevating. He then sang 100 of his most familiar songs and we all joined in. There were many stops along the way. At one, the master offered a huge prasad like a meal in itself, meditating at the front of the bus while we filed past outside and picnicked under the trees. Other times a little bag of sweets or biscuits was placed on the seat opposite him, and we stumbled down the moving bus to take one in turn. The sun blessed us profusely. America shone in all her summer finery and ample beauty. Time ebbed away as it does in good company, and I did not want the drive to end. Preserved with meticulous care since the 1920s, the theatre felt like a walk-in family heirloom. From the illuminated list of events above the entrance to the ornate glass and wooden swing doors, it was like stepping into a black and white film. Inside, the velvet seats, sweeping balcony, and intricate ceiling embraced a modest stage, watched over by a space-age neon-lit chandelier. Sri Chinmoy gave sweet and haunting performances on many instruments, but throughout I could not contain my anticipation for the finale. Nestled in the orchestra pit was a mighty Wurlitzer organ, used for music and sound effects in the days of silent movies. The controlling organ itself was tiny, but by means of keyboards and pedals it commanded a fleet of instruments spanning the whole pit. A piano, a vibraphone, drums and a siren were among the players in the remote-controlled orchestra. They created more than just an experience of sound. Little light bulbs the size of golf balls, in all different colours, were attached to almost every component of the instruments. The top row of organ keys produced a flurry of bells and accompanying twinkles of light pulsing along the stage. It was all as though from another world, like a strange and delightful dream, only stranger and more delightful. I had noted before that the master seemed to suit every possible colour of clothing. I was reminded that he also seemed able to turn his hand to any instrument, from the power of a grand piano to the frolic of a piccolo. Although that organ was entirely new to him, he seemed to thrill at its childlike charm. The sounds and lights were as flocks of imps or fairies dancing and playing much too quickly to be seen. It all went very quiet on the bus as we boarded about midnight. One would expect that everyone, perhaps including Sri Chinmoy, would be tired after such a day. The master did not take a moment's rest, though, even after his extensive performance, but took out a book of funny quotes and started reading them over the microphone, chuckling as he went along. I giggled inside, without the energy by then to manifest it as proper laughter. I think everyone else felt the same, but he was undeterred, eventually asking in a full voice of mischief whether anyone was awake. I laughed out loud at last, fondly, at his inexhaustible energy and joy. I woke at 5, already smiling softly as mist covered the huge verdant scene sweeping by outside. Wildflowers in great clouds added to the gentleness and perfection. The sun hung bright orange with a red rim as I had never seen it. Later, Sri Chinmoy wrote 27 songs, mostly in Bengali, which we all sang together. After Prasad, I was sure I could not have been happier, but someone was beckoning me to the front of the bus for my birthday blessing. I jogged forward in surprise. My guru's hand extended past the side of his blanket, signalling for me to sit across the aisle. I looked up to see a camera pointing towards me and the master behind it. There was no time to compose myself before the flash went off. I made to leave then, anyway, disappointed with my own lack of poise. "No, stay there." He moved back and seemed to take a long time focusing, but that could have been a charade. I felt the same oceanic power as I had on other birthdays and was grateful to be seated for it that time. Although the camera came down after 2 more flashes, he did not look at me without the lens.
"Very good,"